So, let's see. Okay, we have on the phone with us, Garrett Scott is a producer and director of a film that has just come out regarding Fallujah. As you may be aware, a year or so ago, is it over a year now that Fallujah essentially got destroyed by the U.S.? Was it the Marines exclusively with the Air Force, or how many types of...
Yes, it was the Marines. The Marines, the main force was the Marines, and then they were supported by the Army and the Air Force, of course. And there were two separate assaults, one that wasn't especially effective in April of 2004, and then the second, much larger assault that was successful was in November of 2004.
Okay, and so your film, which is called Occupation Dreamland, and this is currently running here in San Francisco down at the Roxy Theater, and as I understand it, it's going to go for at least another week, which will be into almost mid-August. Occupation Dreamland is about life in Fallujah after the United States invaded and up to, what, I think you told me off-air that it was about late February where you stopped filming.
Yeah.
And so the destruction that we know of Fallujah pretty much happened in March and April of that. So in essence, your film doesn't include the utter destruction of Fallujah, but it's actually a very useful film because it will have footage of what it was like before the utter destruction.
That's right.
Yeah, tell us about it. How did you happen to be there? Were you an embedded or were you an unembedded? You had some of both?
Well, what we did was we embedded with the Army, the 82nd Airborne in Fallujah. And I had intended to cover the war in some way right after the invasion through the eyes of these American soldiers. And I felt like that would be the most effective way to cover the conflict as it unfolded for me because, of course, I don't speak Arabic. And, you know, I grew up in San Diego and was somewhat familiar with military people, and I thought this would be a useful way to go beyond stereotypes about what's happening there. And I just felt like the best way to sort of get involved with a lengthy character study would be through the military side. Now, that said, I was very worried that this would somehow create this ideological identification with the Army only, and we wouldn't be able to see the Iraqi side. So, you know, it's really from this particular perspective, but the idea was that if somebody could watch this over the course of an hour and a half and see things progress over a number of weeks, they'd be able to make guesses about how Army operations work and whether they're effective or not. And, you know, these things should be viewed with a cold eye, and that was the plan. And then at the same time, I wanted to try to create some kind of impression of the change these men go through because, I mean, a lot of them are friends of mine. They're great guys, and as we all know in this world, if you're in the right position, that wonderful people can do terrible things.
And as the people you're just talking about, these are the residents of Fallujah. And Fallujah, if I understand right, was approximately a third of a million people. And
About 250 to 300,000 people.
Okay. Well, that's actually approximately the size of St. Louis, slightly larger.
It's a big place.
Yeah. Yeah. St. Louis used
very
to be...
Very dense.
Yeah. St. Louis used to be a million people, but it's down to something like a quarter of a million people. So,
mm-hmm.
Yeah, very comparable to the size of St. Louis. And so, you know, obviously St. Louis has got many different neighborhoods, many different types of industries and a variety of different types of religions and cultures and whatnot. So when you're talking about being friends with the citizens of Fallujah, it's very easy to imagine that you could have, you know, every kind of cross-section of people that you could imagine.
Well, I think I'm making the wrong impression. We were embedded with the Army. So what I meant was that we had to be with the Army people. So the people I said I made friends with were all in the military. We couldn't leave those guys once we decided to align ourselves with them. So okay. What we did is we would go into Fallujah with the Army as they were running their patrols and their various missions. And what I meant was we made friends with those guys. We couldn't leave them and, you know, form relationships with the Iraqis. So, you know, it's a very particular point of view of what was happening in Fallujah at the time, but I think it provides a lot of insight into why tensions escalated there, how the Army contributed to that, the kinds of things they did to try to avoid, you know, simply invading the place. And, you know, what led up to that invasion in the end? You know, it was just a terrible waste of people for absolutely no reason.
Absolutely. As people, listeners might remember, Fallujah was the place where, shortly after the invasion, there was the roadside bombing, which, was it a roadside bombing which stopped the vehicle? That there were four contractors. I'm not sure if they were Halliburton contractors, but there were four contractors that were stopped. The car caught fire. I'm not sure if I remember if there was gunfire as well, but essentially the four contractors were killed, and then their charred bodies were hung from a bridge. So America, according to Fox News, had a thing in for Fallujah because all of those residents were, they killed our four contractors.
That's right. Well, and what actually happened was there was this point where the Army was leaving and the Marines were coming in. And the Marines were, you know, trying new tactics as they were inheriting the town, as it were. And they were going on a lot of small missions into town, and they got into a lot of firefights for no reason, and they killed a bunch of people. And this took place over the course of 3 to 5 weeks as they were sort of relearning everything. So people were really, you know, incensed is not the word in Fallujah. I mean, they had been suffering a lot of humiliation for a long time, for months and months, you know, close to a year. And this was sort of the final capper, all these engagements in the Marines. Now, in the middle of this, these I think it was 6 to 8 guys and 2, maybe 3 trucks drove through the middle of town. They were Blackwater contractors. And nobody knows why they did it, and it was the worst and most unrealistic thing they could have done because they didn't have any backup or support. They're on this incredibly dangerous road that I've been down many, many times. And somebody jumped out from behind a car and simply started shooting up the first car. The first car was stopped. The second car tried to pull away that was following, and then they shot up that car. And they killed all those guys, and I think one car might have escaped. So those images came out on television almost immediately because there was a cameraman near. And suddenly a local problem for the Marines became, you know, a global problem for the Bush administration. And part of the reason why they invaded is that you're exactly right. It looked bad. It created this terrible impression that this pirate town was out of control, which of course was not the case. And a strong move had to be undertaken. So the Marines were actually ordered to assault the town because of those images, frankly.
And as I understand it, of course, this was after you left, but the head of the International Red Cross has said, since the destruction of Fallujah, that there is not a single habitable building left in the city. Now, as you and I were talking before we started this interview, and it's your understanding that there are habitable buildings, but essentially the sewage system, the freshwater system, the
electricity,
it's decimated. So it's essentially a very dangerous place to live because of every different kind of disease you can catch there. There's
the
no way.
The infrastructure just doesn't function, and these things take, you know, 50 to 100. They take an incredibly long time to accumulate, and they don't just come back once you, you know, destroy them in 15 or 20 different ways, you know?
Right, right. So it's, you know, if you had, you know, open fields and meadows and then you wanted to build a city, you could lay down pipes before you build houses. But in this case, you've got rubble everywhere. You've got probably depleted uranium everywhere. You've got a population who can't stand you. So the idea of being able to go in there with trenchers to lay out pipes is difficult at best, much less hazardous at an extreme. So
nicely,
yeah, and
I think everything you say is true except for the depleted uranium. That's actually,
well, they didn't use that there, or do you don't?
Oh,
know
that's not accurate, but it doesn't matter. I mean, that's sort of a very specialized thing they use against tanks. But I mean, it doesn't matter. They wiped everybody out that was resisting them in all the ways you've described, and like you said. They're no better off than they were. They're worse off than they were. I mean, the U.S. in terms of their image and their security situation, because nobody's going to go in there and try to rebuild any of these things when they're setting off bombs all over the place, setting up ambushes for them in exactly the same ways they were before. So everything's just sort of stuck in this terrible state of inertia.
Right, and for a city as big as St. Louis, a quarter of a million, over a quarter of a million people, that's decimating. And you can't just set people up into camps or something like that. You know, the United Nations setting up some kind of refugee camps, it's pretty difficult to deal with a quarter of a million people.
No, and these consequences never occur to anybody. They only think about these immediate things, make them pay or something, or who knows what they were thinking.
Well, that was it. By the way, the very useful thing about your film is that it's going to show footage of what it was like in the city prior to this decimation.
That's right.
And so with that in mind, you know, obviously there was the sanctions that were going on for the previous decade,
mm-hmm.
12 years or more. What was Fallujah like in particular? Were they a city that was hard hit with, you know, lack of hospitals, lack of sewage system, whatnot? Was Fallujah a city that was spared by the privatization, or was it essentially also pretty well hurting from the sanctions?
Well, I think it's fair to say that all of Iraq was in fairly bad shape in terms of infrastructure. I mean, there was an ongoing decline ever since the war with Iran began in 1979, and then continued on to the Gulf War, and then the 10 years of sanctions. But so that's definitely true. But that said, I think Fallujah was actually in a pretty good spot. It's a very interesting place. It's about 50 kilometers east of Baghdad, and it's right on, I believe it's the Euphrates River as it sort of curves west to move to Baghdad. But so it's on this river, and it's also on a main highway that goes directly through it. The highway runs between Amman, Jordan, and Baghdad. So, traditionally, Fallujah is a tribal center for this vast region of territory, different Arabic tribes, that runs from the coast in Jordan all the way to Baghdad. And if you want to bring goods or supplies from the coast through Jordan into Baghdad, you have to go through Fallujah. So it's a transit center in many ways, and it's a very, very old transit center, like thousands of years old. So there's a long tradition of the people in this town overseeing the movement of goods, services, supplies, whatever, back and forth between Baghdad and Jordan on the coast. And that means these people have a lot of power. So Hussein, while he didn't always get along with the Fallujahs, he had to work with them. And so they had sort of a special relationship with the government, and they also had a special relationship to money and income that, you know, other poor agricultural towns in Iraq did not. So in some ways it was an independent town, a fiercely independent town, and those people are very proud of it. And I think that's one reason why they felt like they had a lot to lose when the U.S. purged the Baptists and when the U.S. took over, and they weren't necessarily happy about Americans telling them what to do.
Right. It would be considered then a very one of the international cities of Iraq, Baghdad being one, but because of the Euphrates port, I take it there was probably barge traffic up and down the river.
If you want to go north to south down those rivers, you automatically go through Fallujah, and if you're on the main road from east to west between Baghdad and the Jordanian capital, again, you go through Fallujah.
Sure. So in many ways, it's very equal to St. Louis in that second way.
Definitely. But
Mississippi
River. 10 times as old.
Yeah, the Mississippi River and Highway 70 and Highway 55, intersection of interstate highways as well as the major Mississippi River port. So comparing St. Louis of America, and then as you're saying, the antiquities of it, I would take it that they also have a very established art culture, and to decimate a city like that very much destroys the vitality of the education system, as well as their institutional memory, their cultural memory of the nation or the region.
Quite possibly, although it's a very old culture, and I think they've been undergoing, you know, various traumas. Certainly nothing like this, but I doubt you can't. You know, what am I trying to say? You can't keep Fallujah down. This is going to go on for a long time.
Well, sure. But in other words, if you're going to bomb,
I agree with what you're saying completely.
Yeah, I don't have the statistics with me, but it's my understanding that they, well, just in the very opening days of the war, not including Fallujah, they dropped a third of the U.S. arsenal of cruise missiles in something like a week.
Yeah.
A third of America's arsenal was used up in a week of cruise missiles, plus the tonnage of regular bombs and whatnot.
Yeah.
So Fallujah was another massive destruction of a city entire as big as St. Louis. That's pretty awesome to imagine what it takes.
It's impossible to imagine. I can't even imagine it. I mean, and I've been there. I mean, for that reason especially, I can't imagine the extent of the damage done. It's too horrible to think about.
Sure.
And what's interesting too is that Fallujah was spared in the initial invasion. It was not considered a target at all. So they suffered no damage. The invasion completely bypassed them.
Okay. All right. Now tell us. We have some image, you know, here in America that Iraq is one massive desert. Now, that's completely inaccurate.
That's right.
The ancient biblical scholars always believed that a Garden of Eden that was between the Tigris and Euphrates, that there was this lush jungle of fauna and flora and life form, so that the Garden of Eden was in modern Iraq. And so what's the terrain like near Fallujah?
Well, what's the best way to describe it? When you're driving, you drive through the desert, the western desert, in order to get to Fallujah and Baghdad from Amman. And that looks like, you know, the sort of lunar landscape we all consider a real desert to look like. I mean, it's incredibly hot, and there's nothing that grows. There aren't sand dunes. It's just very rocky and flat and reddish. And then all of a sudden, you come within, you know, a few kilometers of those rivers, and you see palm trees and, you know, green fields. Very strange, very rapid transition in terrain. And then, you know, that sort of continues as you move towards Baghdad. So that whole zone between those two rivers reminds me of areas in California, you know. And it does become very green. And, you know, since those two rivers run from the north all the way to the south, I imagine that belt, that northern-southern belt or conduit of green what would we say, fertile land, you know, continues all the way through Iraq.
Yeah, it's interesting that the land being of such antiquity, we don't really ever think about it as being once lush, but various of these mighty cities, Babylon and Ur and whatnot, they had to have been lush if they were as large as they were. So 1,000 or so years ago, they had many of the same environmental problems that we had. Mm-hmm. They clear cut everything. They did slash and burn techniques. They overgrazed. They had various wars, and they essentially ruined their soil and then many times the military, in order to keep a watchful eye on the enemies from afar, they clear cut everything so that they can look for miles and see an enemy coming. So the idea of turning a fertile land into a wasteland to suit the military is something that's obviously happened back there many times. As a matter of fact, just as a side note, I read, I'm not sure if you're familiar with who Bernard Baruch is, but in the early 20th century, he was very much an economist, and he wrote a foreword to an early environmental book, and he was talking about the 10 curses that Moses laid upon Egypt, and he looked at them from the environmental viewpoint. So the idea that the frogs invading Egypt, that came from draining the swamps. The plague of locusts came from slash and burn techniques. The sewage problems created the boils and whatnot. So the idea that an ancient land like this has always been a crusty desert is not necessarily true. It's usually war and bad agricultural or environmental planning that that creates these situations. So tell us, you've got this film up at the Roxy. It'll be running until next week and then possibly longer if we start to get a draw out there. What can you, are there any high points that you think people should look out for? Obviously, it sounds like part two is something that's going to be needed.
What do you mean by part two?
Well, an aftermath. You know, I'm not sure if you have plans to do it, but there will be films in the next year or decades that we'll talk about.
Oh, yeah, definitely. Well, I'd certainly like to see something about what's happening there now, and I think one thing that would be nice to see would be an in-depth study or analysis of the Iraqis who live there, because unfortunately that's what, you know, we all rarely see. It's not so difficult for me to make something about the military, and I think that's very valuable, but it's about individuals in the military, and I think a lot of what happens in terms of the conflict over there is the worlds inside each of these individuals are, you know, they just disappear completely. And from the Iraqi side, I think all we really see are people in fear or, you know, masked people that are, you know, running around holding weapons. But you never know anything about those people in terms of their lives, you know. And I'd really like to see something of that sort, in Fallujah especially.
Well, sure. And when you think about it, you know, it's obvious that Fox News lied about 400 other aspects of this war. So the idea that they can play the same 2 seconds of footage over and over and over again with no context just leads up to the idea of massive propaganda.
Yeah.
Crosses my mind as well, since you were embedded with the, now you were with the 82nd Airborne, mm-hmm. and you were talking about this was somewhat of the buildup. The contractor's deaths that occurred while you were there?
No, that happened right after. I'd say that happened maybe 4 or 5 weeks after we left.
Oh, I see. Okay, so there was the 82nd Airborne were just stationed nearby, and what was their daily routine?
Their daily routine split into two different functions. At the time, the Army didn't consider, and they were trying to avoid considering Fallujah as the enemy. They saw it as another town that they were occupying, that they had trouble in. But there was no sense of, you know, going to war against the Fallujans or something like that. Although tensions were very high. So what they would do is they tried to avoid going into town in daylight when they would be attacked. It was a certainty. Not in force, but they would put their men at risk by putting them into town in the daytime. And they also knew that they were putting the Iraqis at risk, because once they get contact, as they call it, innocent people are going to die all over the place. And they just didn't. They just knew what the result of something like that would be. So we would go into town maybe once, maybe twice a week to create some kind of relationship with the local government, and that was a regular event, and they would even be attacked then. And then the rest of the time, they would wait and go in at night when they had the advantage and they felt like they could move and operate with, relative safety or security. And so during these night missions, they would go to various houses that they felt housed, members of the resistance or the insurgency, take them, abduct them out of their homes, and bring them back to the camp, where they would interrogate them and either let them go or move them off to Abu Ghraib, which was just down the road from us. So it was a very disturbing situation. I mean, at the time, Fallujah was sort of a big police operation for them. They were just crawling with special forces people and, special this, special that. They would collect information on people in the town, and then they'd go in at night and try to take them. And this just made people angrier and angrier and angrier, as you can imagine.
Sure. Well, as you mentioned, Abu Ghraib, you say it was just down the road.
It was about 15 kilometers.
Which is a little over 10 miles.
Yeah.
Yeah, the idea that, let's see, if I understand right, many of the famous photographs that we've heard from Abu Ghraib were taken, was that February and March of that same year? So were you hearing rumors of what was going on in Abu Ghraib?
No, I mean, these are big, big institutions and collections of people. So I'll say it in two ways. One, the army is designed to, or the military is designed to allow very little freedom of information. So you don't know that much about what's going on, even in the next company. And it's supposed to be that way because they don't want people wondering about things, getting confused about things, or getting the wrong ideas about things. Now, at the same time, none of the torture in Abu Ghraib surprised me particularly, because it seemed like there was so much ugliness and violence going on everywhere in all sorts of ways that something like that was not beyond the pale of imagination. And, considering how helpless these people are, and what the army people think about them, and the level of anger that both sides have, level of fury that both sides have, I assume things like that are going on all the time and still are.
Sure, sure. Hey, well, we thank you, Garrett. So again, your film Occupation Dreamland is running here in San Francisco, and this interview, of course, is being done in early August of 2005. And do you have a website for your film company, Operation Dreamland?
Yeah, go to the website. It's www.occupationdreamland.
And then
.com.
Yeah, in the title of it, it's got a colon in there. Do you have the colon in the website?
But not in the not on the website.
All right, good. And then operationdreamland.com.
Occupationdreamland.com.
Yeah, great. And all right, well, good. Yeah, we sure appreciate your interview, and we'll make a point to go up there and take a look at the film.
I feel very fortunate, David. Thanks so much.
Oh, no trouble. Yeah, thanks for your efforts.
I hope I wasn't too long-winded.
Oh, no, it's a good interview.
All right, buddy.
All right, thanks again.
Have a good day. Take care.
So, yeah, the producer and director of Occupation Dreamland, one serious movie about what's going on in Iraq.